Right now, I'm very happy to welcome to our program Carrie Shenkman. He's a U.S.-based attorney working on behalf of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, who's been granted asylum and been sequestered in Ecuador's London embassy for 3.5 years in order to avoid being extradited to Sweden to face a sexual assault charge there that he says is politically motivated, and a ploy to have the Swedish government extradite him to the U.S. to face charges for his release of embarrassing secret U.S. documents, diplomatic and military documents, really. Carrie, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on the program, Scott.
So there's been some recent developments our listeners may be aware of in Julian Assange's case. But before we get to those, maybe briefly explain in some more detail the legal situation that Julian Assange faces that really led 3.5 years ago to his extended stay in Ecuador's London embassy.
Absolutely. So in 2010, our listeners might remember when WikiLeaks made global headlines by exposing war crimes, cover-ups, evidence of torture, and many other really gross violations of international law that the U.S. was keeping secret. After WikiLeaks exposed those, U.S. really carried forward a unprecedented criminal case against Julian Assange and WikiLeaks that involved several government agencies. It was described actually by Australian diplomatic sources as an unprecedented case. It's a case that free press organizations say would have disastrous consequences for freedom of the press. So basically the issue is if the U.S. were to prosecute WikiLeaks for publication, how is that any different than saying you're going to prosecute the New York Times or Washington Post or other papers for publishing in the public interest? So really the whole case in the asylum is about this continued threat of prosecution from the United States. And I would clarify one thing, actually, from the introduction, that Assange was granted asylum not in response to Sweden. Actually, Sweden and the UK have nothing to do with the asylum that Mr. Assange enjoys. It's really about the United States and the threat of persecution on political grounds by the United States. So in 2012, Ecuador granted him asylum, and he's enjoyed that asylum for 3.5 years, but the only way he can maintain that right of asylum is by remaining in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. So there has been a separate case in Sweden involving sexual allegations, actually in 2010, that case was against him was dropped. Those allegations were dropped. He hasn't been charged with a crime in Sweden. And for the last 5 years, he said that he wants to clear his name and present his side of the story. The problem for Mr. Assange is Sweden and the UK have basically only given him an either or. So he can either enjoy his asylum in the embassy or go to Sweden. But there's no way for him right now to both clear his name and also keep enjoying his asylum. So that's the reason he's still in the embassy. So fast forward to today, that's a little bit of the legal background. Fast forward to today.
Can I just stop you there?
Win in the UN.
Carrie, can I just stop you there? Just a quick clarification. Although you said that the charges were dropped, why is Sweden still pursuing this case, and why is are British authorities hell bent on sending him to Sweden if the charges are no longer there?
Yeah, so he was never charged and still hasn't been charged, and that's very, very important. So we're not even at the case where he's been charged with any crime in Sweden. A prosecutor simply wants to question him. And really, and that was instrumental in this big UN win, what the UN came forward and said is that it's really incompatible with the presumption of innocence to detain someone for 5 years just to be questioned. He's been available for questioning for the last 5 years. For several years, the Swedish prosecutors said that they wouldn't come to London to do it. Just last year, reverse course, and has been actually widely criticized for that. The UK actually changed their law to prevent someone from being extradited in a case like Julian's. So last year there was a law passed basically in response to his case that wouldn't wouldn't allow extraditions going forward just for the purpose of questioning, because it was a big scandal in Europe. You had people who were getting extradited just for being accused of stealing a cell phone or a pig or something really, really minimal, and you think to yourself, why would he ever be extradited for questioning related to an alleged offense?
Mm-hmm.
So it really raises serious questions why Sweden and the UK are still pushing so hard to keep him detained what are the early stages of a case that he was previously cleared on.
All right. Well, let me just ask you the question that leads to the next chapter in this. There was a recent ruling by the United Nations Working Group on Arbitrary Detention, which found Julian Assange's detention should come to an end and that he has the right to compensation. Tell us about that ruling and its importance.
Right. So for the last 16 months, the UN's highest authority on detention has been conducting an independent investigation into the case. And after examining all the evidence that the UK and Sweden presented, on Friday, the UN announced that both countries were arbitrarily detaining Assange. So what that means is that the UN acknowledged that he is, in fact, detained, and second, that the reason for that detention is unjustified. So there's really two important pieces that come out of that. One, this is in effect the UN acknowledging the risk of onward extradition that Mr. Assange faces to the United States. And that sets a very important precedent for whistleblowers. As many listeners know, Edward Snowden currently enjoys asylum in Russia after disclosing NSA documents that have resulted in several U.S. programs being held unlawful by two branches of government. And it's widely recognized that whistleblowers face unprecedented persecution in the United States. So this is really kind of another step in that recognition of the risks that whistleblowers face. And the second part is that the underlying detention is not justified any longer, because Sweden's really been dragging its feet with this case, hasn't been responding to the calls to question him. So that's why the UN came forward and said that Assange is arbitrarily detained and entitled to compensation.
And this United Nations Working Group's ruling, as I understand it, really doesn't have the force of law in Britain or anywhere else. What is the concrete result of this ruling, if you would tell us?
Well, as an international lawyer, I can say actually that the reports that this doesn't have the force of law are actually factually incorrect. Actually, the West regularly relies on decisions by this working group when Western nationals are detained. So recently, the president of Maldives was released following an opinion by the working group. And actually, the Washington Post, many listeners might remember, a Post journalist was detained in Iran by the name of Jason Rezaian. And actually, one of the very first things that the Post did was file an urgent petition with this very same group that decided in Assange's case. And what's really interesting is if you put side by side the way that, like the New York Times and many outlets have written about this UN group in the Washington Post case, contrasted with Assange's case, there's really a black and white difference between the attitude towards the group, showing a lot of respect in the former and dismissal in the latter. So this is something that does carry the force of law. It is based on binding international legal obligations, and I think the most compelling point from our perspective filing the thing is that the UK and Sweden actually participated in this process and submitted to the jurisdiction of this body. They didn't simply ignore it. We worked responding to the arguments of both countries, so it really is something where I think I'd present a very interesting thought experiment to listeners to pose a question. What if this opinion turned out against Mr. Assange? So instead of being a favor saying that he was arbitrarily detained, what if the UN came out and said, oh, Assange is not being detained, the UK and Sweden are justified? You could bet that they would be all over praising this working group, praising the UN, accepting this outcome. So what we really have is a case of cherry picking and both countries complaining because they didn't like the outcome.
What's been the British government response to this UN working group's ruling here?
So they're was an outrageous statement by the UK Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond, where he called the opinion ridiculous. And this actually was quickly condemned by human rights organizations. So the General Counsel for Human Rights Watch, she called the UK response deplorable. I've gotten countless contacts from different human rights organizations saying how they've been shocked at the UK and Swedish dismissal of this opinion, because it's really something that's, you know, that type of attitude is really counterproductive for both countries, because as I mentioned before, both countries really rely on this group when Western and UK and Swedish nationals are detained. So what's going to happen next? You're going to have, like, suppose a journalist is detained in Vietnam or China or Myanmar or one of these quote-unquote, like, usual offenders. It's like the next time you have a UK journalist detained, those countries are just going to look to the statement by the UK and say, hey, the UK didn't follow the UN in the Assange case, so why do we have to do anything now? So what it does is it really sets a precedent that undermines the rule of international law, and it's really unbecoming of two countries that pride themselves on their human rights records. It's quite disappointing, but I would caution that it's not necessarily indicative of the long-term outcome. I mean, a little bit of resistance is certainly expected, but I think this decision will definitely open up a lot of negotiation and legal paths in the future.
We're speaking with Kerry Shankman, a U.S.-based attorney working on behalf of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, who's been granted asylum and been sequestered in Ecuador's London embassy for 3.5 years. We've been talking about a recent ruling by the United Nations Working Group on Arbitrary Detention. That ruling found that Julian Assange and his detention at the embassy should come to an end. Kerry, I wanted to ask you, explain briefly to our listeners the charges pending against Julian Assange in the United States that he's concerned he might have to face if he's extradited to Sweden, and Sweden in turn extradites him to the U.S.
So the biggest issue is, as we've been talking about, is the threat of extradition to the United States, where he would face he would face persecution on account of publishing activities. And there's a ongoing case against WikiLeaks and Mr. Assange now over 5 years. Just in December, a quote-unquote sensitive ongoing proceeding was confirmed in DOJ and FBI documents. And there have been different confirmations in federal court opinions confirming that ongoing case, and essentially that's what this is all about, and that's what the asylum is about. The effects of a prosecution of WikiLeaks, as I mentioned, would be to set a precedent that mainstream newspapers would have to second guess whenever they publish classified materials or materials that are critical or expose embarrassing secrets of the U.S. government. And this is something that every paper engages in on a daily basis. It's actually one of the tenets on which freedom of the press was founded. The First Amendment protects a open, robust, and uninhibited press for the reason that freedom of the press is required to have effective checks on government, and also to make sure that we as citizens can participate and know how can we vote, how can we participate democratically without knowing what's actually happening with our government. And that, of course, is the reason why we have freedom of information laws. That's why we have a strong First Amendment. But really what the case against Mr. Assange and WikiLeaks threatens to do is undermine the very core of the First Amendment. And that actually is one reason why free press organizations around the world condemn the ongoing case. Actually, just after the UN decision came out, Anthony Romero, who's the executive director of the ACLU, he put out a statement in support of the opinion, and he said that the U.S. case against Mr. Assange is, quote, unprecedented and unconstitutional.
Thank you, Kerry. You know, it might be worth just spending a minute or so on this question. What's the legal distinction between an activist who's interested in pursuing social justice, releasing documents about some wrongdoing that they uncovered, and a journalist doing the same thing?
Well, I mean, I mean, certainly, there's organizations that support Mr. Assange. They don't recognize you know, they don't recognize such a distinction legally. I think in terms of First Amendment law, there are quite a few cases, and starting early on in the 20th century, questions of really who's a journalist. And actually, the Supreme Court has never drawn a circle around journalism. And this is actually a very important principle in terms of the First Amendment, because if the law begins to recognize who's a journalist and who's not a journalist, then you have a form of licensing that happens in journalism. And that's actually one of the reasons that the U.S. broke away from England, is that England had a licensing of the press system where the press had to file for permission from the king before they could print. So early on in the U.S., the way that media spread was via pamphleteers. And a lot of First Amendment Supreme Court cases make reference to these pamphleteers who were self-printers, like Thomas Paine's Common Sense. That was one of the most famous pamphlets in U.S. history. And, of course, by many of the arguments being put forward by, you know, journalists versus activists, Thomas Paine would not be a journalist, which is kind of a ludicrous thing to think about, considering the impact he's had on the development of our Constitution. So really, in terms of the First Amendment, there's, you know, what really matters is someone disseminating information to the public. And that's a, you know, that's a wide standard, and it's wide for a reason, and it's one that the law has upheld, both actually in the courts and also reflected in things like journalist protection laws, that we really need to have a wide view of what journalism is.
Kerry, are you concerned that this case with Julian Assange could lead to a situation where courts rule that journalists could must be licensed in the future? It's kind of a scary thought.
Yeah, you know, if you look historically, so the law that one of the laws that's been cited around the WikiLeaks case is called the Espionage Act. And we know that because there were search warrants issued by the DOJ for the Google accounts of several WikiLeaks staffers. The search warrants were issued in 2012, but we didn't actually learn about them until 2 years later, because Google was under a very strict gag order. Google actually, and their counsel, they tried to fight those gag orders for years, but were unsuccessful. So that really gives you a sense of just how secret this case has been, that even the mighty Google hasn't been able to shake off that secrecy for many years. So, but in those search warrants, there are many provisions cited that the investigation entailed, and one of those was the Espionage Act. So this Espionage Act was passed in 1917 during World War I, and the pretext was prosecuting spies, but it actually, for the first 2,000 prosecutions, it wasn't used against a single spy. It was used against people who opposed World War I. And historically, there actually have been some attempts to use that law against the mainstream press, but none of those have been successful. So certainly, in terms of the First Amendment, I think there would be a very, very strong defense based on the history of this law and also our general First Amendment principles against punishing a publisher for publishing classified materials, because it would have deleterious effects on our whole newspaper industry, on the very basic principles of the First Amendment. But, of course, that doesn't change the fact that there have been attempts in the past, and the fact that, you know, presidents like President Nixon have tried to use this law against the New York Times. That is kind of scary, that despite the First Amendment principles, there have been attempts to use it against the press.
Kerry, given the current situation with the British government's response to this UN panel thus far, what legal recourse does Julian Assange have now, as he sits for 3.5 years now in Ecuador's embassy in London?
Well, the opinion just came out on Friday, so we're still reviewing the opinion and consulting with lawyers in various jurisdictions about the remedies that that may open up. But kind of the short response is that this opinion certainly opens up paths legally and in terms of future negotiation as well. A lot of arbitrary detention situations, especially high profile cases that this group tackles, are typically resolved via negotiation. Maybe not right away, so not the first day, not the first week, but after a few months, I think after the initial PR dust settles, you might see an outcome where some sort of deal is reached with the government, so the UN is able to sufficiently bring everyone to the bargaining table. So certainly our first look would be to the governments to implement this opinion in accord with their international legal obligations. And then following that, then we would explore whatever legal avenues it would open up.
Well, just a final question, Kerry, and that is this. Have you seen evidence of a chilling effect on journalism and activists providing heretofore secret documents revealing wrongdoing by governments or corporations as a result of what's happened to Julian Assange?
I think absolutely. I mean, there's no question about it. I'm actually working on a book about the Espionage Act, and one of the things that I've learned in that research is that this law is one that is considered by the mainstream press, but I think following the WikiLeaks case and the publicity it's received, I think a lot of the big outlets are very concerned about publication. Now you have some courageous publications like The Intercept, which regularly publish the Snowden documents, and they still have shops set up. So I think we're not quite at the stage where we have a completely censored press. But I do know, and you see it with actually mainstream journalists. So you have like James Rosen, James Risen, who've been dragged through the mud by the Espionage Act because of their alleged relationships with their sources.
Well, Kerry, thank you so much for spending time with us. Is there a website that our listeners can go to find out more about Julian Assange's case and the things we've been talking about this evening?
Yeah, there's two sites I might recommend. One that has quite a bit of coverage of this case has been kind of a repository for the briefs and such, is justiceforassange.com. Justice for the number four, not spelled out. So justiceforassange.com. And then the other is the site for the firm that I work with, ccrjustice.org. So I work for constitutional lawyer Michael Ratner, who's the president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights, which many listeners might know is extremely active in the New York community. A broad successful stop and frisk case against the NYPD, has been involved in Muslim surveillance, torture, Guantanamo for years. So, and CCR also represents WikiLeaks and Julian Assange.
Well, Kerry, thanks so much for all your very important work on this case and for journalism and freedom of expression and to protect whistleblowers who are trying to do the right thing. So appreciate that. And also, I want to thank you especially for overcoming some obstacles tonight to be with us. So thanks so much.
All right. Thank you so much.
We'll stay in touch. Appreciate it, Kerry. Good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That's Kerry Shenkman, U.S.-based attorney working on behalf of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, who's been sequestered in Ecuador's London embassy for 3.5 years. We're talking about a recent United Nations panel's ruling that his detention there is unlawful and he should be free to go, something that has not happened yet, but you heard the details here this evening.